You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 28th of July 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly dose of books, music and magazines. We're live from Studio One at Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be visiting independent booksellers to find out what's been selling well in Milan, Phnom Penh and Berlin.
It takes at least a year to realise what people really want, what the neighbourhood is like, who are your customers.
We'll be talking K-pop with music producer, DJ and Korean popular culture guru Bernie Cho.
And we'll be indulging in our weekly magazine review with Jules Wright, the founder of The Whopping Project, a restaurant and cultural hub in southeast London.
All that, and we haven't even mentioned the Olympics yet. That's right here on The Review on Monocle 24.
We haven't mentioned the Olympics, but I think we're just about to. Andrew Muller, what an evening last night.
It was. Yeah, bizarre, really. Our three-hour-long daily with contributions from people we'd sort of hauled in from Monocle's opening ceremony party. Most of it, I think, made a certain amount of sense.
Are we talking about the programme or the ceremony itself, which was...
Both.
By all accounts, the ceremony has gone down beautifully. And I don't know about you, but I get the sort of post-wedding feeling this morning that everybody had the knees up to end all knees ups. And everybody is nursing a slightly sore head this morning, but rather pleased with what happened.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to actually watching it with sound and stuff, because we had it on monitors here in the studio, but because we were making sounds of our own, we couldn't really hear what was going on. But I recorded it last night, and I'm going to watch it in its... Both sound and vision when I get home.
In terms of a cultural exercise, it sort of divided opinion, or from what little opinion we canvassed last night, that many people say if you were British, it made 85-90% sense. But if you were not British, you did need a little bit of your hand-holding slightly. Did that matter, do you think?
Well, I don't think it matters. And we were in the enormously privileged position last night of being able to talk to somebody who has actually organised opening and closing ceremonies for Olympic Games. I remember thinking exactly this about the closing ceremony of the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. And I know I said this last night. I was watching that in London, but watching my hometown's Olympics closing ceremony and just thinking... Billions of people around the world are watching my hometown, and they're watching enormous mutant prawns on bicycles and vast inflatable kangaroos, which has sort of been hybridised with Frankenstein's monster.
What I quite enjoyed about last night's ceremony was the reaction that I got from every generation, that you'd talk to people who are, you know, in their teens, 20s, and they got bits of it. And then, you know, I had a very excited phone call from my mother, who is, with respect, not in her teens or 20s anymore. And she found bits that absolutely, you know, made her overjoyed as well. And I think Danny Boyle probably had to throw everything at it, but nonetheless pulled it off.
And also at a micro-political level here in the United Kingdom, it does seem to have upset all the people you would most hope would be upset by that sort of thing, i.e. purse-lipped, sanctimonious wowsers. One particular Conservative MP, Aidan Burley, previously best known for having attended a Nazi-themed stag party, decided to unburden himself of his views on the opening ceremony, possibly after having had one or two drinks on a social network, and has been roundly berated by, at last count, the entire world. And I think his elevation to the cabinet has been delayed until some time past the point at which the earth spins into the sun and our Lord calls us all home.
Have you finished, Andrew?
Just about.
What have we got coming up on The Review, then?
We have bookstores from around the world, as usual. Tonight we are in Italy, Cambodia and Germany.
And we've been doing our homework on K-pop.
When I say tonight, I mean, of course, this afternoon, but as of last night, time has ceased to have any meaning for me at all. Yes, we will be discussing K-pop with Bernie Cho. We have been learning about K-pop. This morning.
We have been learning and practising our dance moves. You and I have utterly unsatisfactory hairdos in preparation for this. We will be asking Bernie about the amount of product used by the South Koreans in their pop music.
And I will be challenging Bernie Cho to sort of contradict my slight suspicion that, frankly, where K-pop is concerned, more thought goes into the hairstyles than the actual records. But that will be interesting, because it is a peculiar and interesting new phenomenon, which has erupted almost from nowhere.
Not new in South Korea, but suddenly becoming incredibly really popular all over the rest of the world. We were looking at a video of a girl group from South Korea playing on the David Letterman show.
Yeah, but no, but it's a relatively new phenomenon in Korea as well, and there are interesting countries where the country formed reasonably recently, as the Republic of South Korea did. And it's analogous, I think, to the popular culture scenes you see sometimes in parts of Europe, which had to recover very quickly after the Second World War and had to import a popular culture almost wholesale, quite often from the homes of their occupiers. It's a weird relationship.
You're listening to The Review. In a moment, we'll be heading to our bookshops. So let's find out what titles have been selling well in Milan, Phnom Penh, and where was the third one? Berlin.
Berlin. And first we're going to Milan, to Parole e Pagine.
My name is Michele Neri. I work for this local bookshop called Parole e Pagine, which means words and pages. We are located into the neighborhood of Brera in the center of Milano. The bookshop was opened 1.5 years ago in order to fill a void in this neighborhood. We knew there were no more independent bookstore in the area, and all the big distribution were morely interested in developing a very bestseller-like policy. Therefore, we found our niche in the way we try to cope directly with the clients. We try to follow their tastes. We try more than that to suggest them a kind of path in the reading, so they come here for a title, and we try to go from that to other region of the narratives, in order to give them a kind of long-term pleasure and affection for the library. Our bookshop is divided into different areas, so we do have all kinds of books, from crimes to science fiction to international and Italian non-fiction. We have, of course, the most important Italian writers of these times and of the past. And beside that, we follow also specific areas as art, architecture, and books from nature and environment. We will try to cover better these areas in the next bookshop, which will be open in the end of 2012, and which will cover a double area than this one. Clients come in to look for books that they've read on magazines, and often they go out with different titles. For example, we managed to make the bestseller of this bookshop for this year this novel, Let the Great World Spin, by Colum McCann, the Pulitzer Prize winner of 2011. The incredible stories of different destinies in the same day of 1974 in Manhattan, when the famous French man Philippe Petit walked through the rope from one World Trade Center tower to the other. Another book they come out with when they come in before is Io e Te by Niccolò Ammanniti. He's a Roman writer, and it's a short story about two brothers. Will be in a movie already directed by Bernardo Bertolucci, which will come out in Italy at the end of 2012 and probably be then translated in the other markets. And there's a third writer I want to mention is Haruki Murakami, the Japanese writer of many novels. Often we try to suggest to the people who have a long time to read this great writer, author of Japan, because it accompanies them through many hours of reading, and each book is related to the other through a fantastic story.
And that was Michele Neri from Parole e Pagine bookstore in Milan, a man who, I love the fact that he's found a niche for, I quote, the long-term pleasure of his clients. I just think that was a sort of, I thought that was just someone who just thinks that books can offer so much more than just reading and just an instant hit. I love the way that he was going to guide his readers through their ongoing reading habits. I love that.
Well, he's kind of right, because it is, unfortunately, an anachronistic pastime. I think if you were going to invent if you're going to invent a thing now, would you invent the book, an idea that people need to sort of devote, you know, several hours of actual quiet contemplative consumption to?
I'd imagine actually that is something that we need more than ever. I mean, as he has obviously found, because if there's no bookstore in the area, there is the anonymity of the big bookshops in the rest of Milan. Clearly, he's found a niche that we used to enjoy.
Well, I hope he's right. Obviously, it sounds like an absolutely lovely shop. Next time I'm in Milan, etc. Next up, we are heading to Cambodia to visit Dee's Books in Phnom Penh.
My name is Wan Pardik. So I'm the owner of this book on Street 240. This book been here for almost 8 years, and we opened up since 2004. I used to be a manager for this book, but now I'm the owner of the bookshop. It's a lot of work because before just manager and you don't have to worry about finance, about anything, but now it's more work and work because you have to responsible for all the import and, you know, like, and this book we got three, so one in Siem Reap, two in Phnom Penh, so that's two is different locations, you know, and we got a lot of stuff to take care of as well. This book we focus more on tourists, so tourists, most of tourists like to read their fiction book. Yeah, so we only focus on like kind of fictions, like novel, right? The most popular books that we sold out recently is very popular now. It's like The Wise Martial Arts, The Book Thief, and the author by Suzanne Collins. Was the first one is called Hunger Game, Catching Fire, and Mockingtail, you know? And also by Harry Potter, so all the first one till the end, like seven. The last one is One Day by David Nicol. So here's the most popular one. It's like this book, Someone's Names by Lawrence Hill. This book I sell a lot, but the thing is, this book is used book, right? So we can't just have too many copy of that book, so we have one, we sold one, you know. And also 3 cups of coffee, tipping point. And also we do have a biography section. So all the famous people around the world, we got in here too. And women section, so women sections, it's kind of quiet now, but we sold a lot to the Cambodian girls, you know, they like to read about Romans, you know, it's love story, so. Here we got for them as well. My favorite book is kind of fiction. So fiction, I like to read about something that's not really true. You know, so it's fiction, right? So it's my author is by Poco Loco, something like that. So it's by, I think he's Italian, I'm not sure, but I love him. You know, so he's a very good writer.
And that was Vantar Duk from Dee's Books in Phnom Penh, a woman who's clearly aware of the responsibility of her job.
Yes, I was intrigued by her her observation that Cambodian girls like to read about Romans.
In the special woman section.
Yeah.
I love the idea of a woman section in a bookshop. I think that's something that possibly should be developed in the United Kingdom and elsewhere, obviously. I wonder what a woman's section in a bookshop would look like, or is it just terribly fluffy?
I'm really just trying to rise above so, so many, many, very many jokes at this point.
Pull yourself together, Muller.
I shall do exactly that, and we shall head to Berlin, where we visit the Shakespeare and Son bookstore.
My name is Roman Kratochvila. I come from Czech Republic. I've been in the book business for 10 years. We've had a Prague shop for 10 years. And last year, my wife and I decided that we would come to Berlin and open a branch of the same shop. We also have one small shop in Český Krumlov, which is a very beautiful town in the south of Czech Republic. I'm spending most of the time here, but I still go back to Prague twice a month because I order all of the books for all the shops, so I want to keep in touch with the other places as well. So we've been in Prague for 10 years, yeah. But here only since last year. So we came here in February and in May we opened the bookshop. So it's been 1 year and a month. It takes at least a year to realize what people really want, what the neighborhood is like, who are your customers. As you know, it's mostly English, but we have a relatively large French section. That's gonna get even much better. And there's lots of French people who live in the neighborhood too. But it's still the main, I think the main part of it will always be the English books. What we do in Prague more than we do here is more sort of scientific books and academic books. We do lots of philosophy, psychology. That doesn't seem to be like that important here. So like what we sell everywhere, of course, it's contemporary fiction. That's it's always probably going to be the main part of the bookshop. But what is very important here in Berlin for us is the graphic novels, the children's books, art, you know, these kind of things, which we also have in Prague, but it's not as big as it is here. The things in the window, like on this side, it's more like children's books, graphic novels. On the other side, there will be, I think for the window, you always want something that looks attractive, that brings people in. So what do we have here? We have the cat in the, what's it called, this one? The Cat in the Hat. Then there's a great children's book called No, It's a Book. I like that very much. Then there's Shortcomings by Adrian Tomin. It's a great graphic novel. There's a book called Bowie in Berlin, which is quite cool. There's The Icon of Man's Style, which is what it has to be in the window so that people come in. Here are the guides and the cookbooks and the new, you know, the new releases. The graphic novels and the children's are here. And the French, in terms of like history and politics. And in the back are more, it's all like the, oh, there's the youth fiction, which is the only section that we sort of split into like youth and new, because otherwise it would just have like one long, long stretch. All the other sections are mixed together. So the youth fiction is these two shelves, and the rest is, like this is sort of more academic, and yeah, as you can see, and there's like the poetry, theater, biography, science fiction, and there's some mystery crime.
And that was Roman Kratochwiller from Shakespeare & Son Bookstore in the Prenzlauer area of Berlin. A man who started off, I thought, was sort of quite subdued, but then one gathered that he had an absolute addiction for books and for building new beautiful bookstores and for following the appetite of his customers.
Yeah, and Shakespeare & Sons was a bit of an institution in Prague. Again, it was something I remember being quite heartening from my travelling in Eastern Europe in the early 90s when walls were coming down and so forth, was people opening bookstores as well as magazines, publications, all sorts of things. But there was, for all sorts of obvious reasons, a renewed enthusiasm for sort of free traffic in words and writing and ideas. It was quite sweet, really, and I think...
And the introduction of foreign ideas, the fact that he specialised in English and French books was a sign that we could now get international expression.
Well, people had always had them, of course, but they no longer had to sort of smuggle them between safe houses in plain brown wrappers. It was a genuinely liberating thing. And it was really sweet. I thought you would name it after Shakespeare.
Delightful.
It was. Anyway, do stay with us here on The Review, because coming up after this break, we will be talking K-pop with Friend of Monocle. We should have badges with that written on
them. They probably do.
They probably are badges.
We just don't have them.
I wonder what they'd be shaped like. They'd be like Blue Peter ones, like the little boat. What would the Monocle one be shaped like?
A little Monochan.
Monochan the owl, indeed. With Friend of Monocle, Bernie Cho from Seoul.
It's that time of year when Monocle packs its trunks and its bikinis and heads to the beach to produce our summer resort newspaper, Monocle Mediterraneo. Our large format paper takes the temperature of the region from Liguria to Lebanon, Marseille to Mallorca.
In the design section, we discover a modernist neighbourhood in Naples, a mid-century gem in Ibiza, and a cool stone creation on Mykonos.
In the edit section, we show you how to cook the Mediterranean way with recipes for Turkish and Lebanese specialties, and we interview the food ambassadors that are shaping the restaurant scene in Italy and Greece.
And we head to Tuscany to find out where US soldiers unwind on Europe's only US military-controlled beach.
Monocle Mediterraneo is on newsstands now. It's the only beach companion you'll need this summer.
You You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, and Andrew Muller on a sunny Olympian Saturday afternoon in London.
Indeed it is, and it's time now on that sunny Olympian Saturday afternoon in London for our weekly music review, and today we're crossing to Seoul, previous Olympic host, for a spot of K-pop. Our guest reviewer is Bernie Cho, who is president of the Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB Collective. Good afternoon, Bernie.
안녕하세요, Andrew and Emma. How are you doing?
We're very well. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. How is sunny Seoul today?
It is not only very sunny, it is very, very hot right now. The humidity is just absolutely killing me, but it doesn't seem to be stopping the music fans from hitting the festivals.
I was about to say, this is the staple. We're now in absolute season now, aren't we? Tell us what's happening over there in terms of the festivals.
Well, what's interesting was years ago, Korea really only had one major summer festival, and over the past few years, more and more festivals have emerged, and instead of cannibalizing each other, if anything, the whole scene has just really exploded and grown. And right now, as we speak, the Jisun Valley Rock Festival, with some of Britain's finest, such as Radiohead and Stone Roses, kicked off this weekend, and for the next 4 weeks, there's just going to be a whole bevy of superstar DJs, bands, artists from all over the world coming in and around Seoul for a series of back-to-back, and even in some cases, some head-to-head festivals, such as the Ultra Music Festival on August 3rd and 4th, Pentapore Rock Festival, August 10th, 12th, the World Electronic Carnival, August 10th and 12th, and then there's a brand spanking new one called the Supersonic Festival, which will be on August 14th through the 15th.
You mentioned Radiohead and the Stone Roses there, and I'm jealous of half of those as a festival lineup. I speak as somebody who saw the Stone Roses first come back in 1996, which is kind of the rock music equivalent of saying, you know, you were there for the Hindenburg. But in general, what kind of European American acts tend to do well in Tokyo?
Not Tokyo, Korea.
Well, in Seoul and in Tokyo, it's funny you mentioned both because
good catch.
A lot of these acts are going back and forth this summer between festivals in both countries, very similar to what happened in 2002 for the World Cup. So instead of football, you have rock bands, hip-hop acts, and electronic DJs going back and forth.
And to what Benny, I interrupted you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. So I guess in terms of some of the more classic acts, as you mentioned, the Stone Roses, you know, for instance, with Supersonic, we have the Smashing Pumpkins and New Order being headliners with acts like Basement Jacks and Foster the People. So it's really a wide range of artists for a wide range of fans. And it's very eclectic, very eccentric, and very exciting all at the same time.
And in terms of what you do, the DFSB Collective, how much of an opportunity is this for you to expose new Korean music? Or is the market so well established there that it just slots in as, you know, another, let's say, tent or stage that people can go to?
What's really interesting for us is, you know, obviously for a lot of the Korean acts that can get onto the lineups of these big local international festivals, it's a great way for them to sort of leverage and go to the next level to festivals in North America or in Europe or in Japan. And we're very excited, for instance, some of the acts that we work with, but more importantly, we're just huge fans of. Will not only be headlining the Supersonic Festival here in Korea, but they'll be jet-setting their live sets over to the mega, mega, massive Supersonic Festival in Japan, which will be on August 18th through the 19th. So it's a great opportunity not only to get exposure locally, but more importantly, to go global as well.
Well, Bernie, you've picked three tracks for us to listen to this afternoon. So tell us about the first of them a little bit first. This is Infinite.
Yes. Infinite is one of the boy bands, one of the bigger boy bands in Korea who have made it and was actually one of the early acts announced for Summer Sonic. What's interesting about Infinite is they sort of kind of didn't really follow the formula on breaking out of Korea. Their popularity in Korea was pretty much simultaneously happening at the same time in Japan. And so it's interesting to see that Infinite, as well as another sort of kind of teen idol in his own right, there's an actor-singer heartthrob by the name of Jang Geun-suk, who will also be performing at Summer Sonic with a project team called Team H. And so what's really interesting about Summer Sonic is they like to go for a balance of the indie acts, the icon acts, as well as the idol acts. But Infinite, I believe the song we have lined up is BTD, Before the Dawn. So I guess, you know, why don't we give it a spin?
We will. Just before we have a listen to it, you mentioned the indie music scene, which we'll move on to after this, but let's for a moment just wallow in the glories of K-pop for a few moments. It's a genre which is stapled now on the Monocle 24 playlist. It is quite a fascinating genre, where it is the total triumph, would you say, of form over substance?
Well, what's interesting is I think now, although K-pop is sort of known for the teen idol dance music, what we're starting to see is the diversity in the music scene here starting to really reach out and go abroad. And so nowadays we're starting to hear people talk about some of the rock acts or the hip-hop acts or even some of the electronic acts who are happen to be popular also being kind of slid into the K-pop umbrella. And so for us, what's exciting is I think the term K-pop itself is a bit, it's going through a little bit of redefinition and redefining right now. So hopefully it's just music that's popular that happens to be K-pop.
What I found astonishing about the, I think we were watching, as we mentioned earlier, a group called, is it Girls' Generation, who appeared on David Letterman. And Andrew and I were quite astonished by the performance because suddenly their sort of innocence and their, they did feel really gauche, didn't they, when you watched them. How well do you think K-pop travels outside South Korea?
It really depends, I think, on the genre as well as in the market. I think, for instance, you know, there's an interest in all types right now. Obviously, you have the idol acts selling out big arenas. At the same time, you have indie acts playing festivals like South by Southwest or Canada Music Week. So, you know, I think for us, what we're seeing is the diversity of genres is showing that there's a diversity of audiences. I think Korean music doesn't satisfy everyone, but it definitely satisfies a lot of people for a lot of different reasons.
Okay, well, let's give Infinite a try.
And that was Infinite and Before the Dawn, a group who arguably, I think their bathroom cabinets must be bigger than the size of a small country, I'd imagine. Bernie Cho, listening to that, there's a really interesting mix of English in there. I mean, how important is that in K-pop?
Yeah, it's very interesting, as I think before Korean music, you know, started really going beyond Asia, just within Asia and across Asia, K-pop, I think, travels and more importantly sells as well as perhaps just Western pop music because it's so accessible. You're finding that a lot of Korean acts are singing their lyrics in Korean, but more often than not are singing their choruses in English. And so to a music fan, whether they be in Tokyo or in Thailand or in Taiwan, when they hear a Korean track, to them it really isn't that different than hearing perhaps, you know, an English track that they hear from the UK or the US or from wherever. And I think, you know, through a lot of trial and error, Korean acts have kind of figured out what that balance is that makes the music, you know, sell well, but more importantly, travel well.
It's an absolutely ruthless enshrinement of the idea that the chorus is what's important, though, isn't it? That the hook's all really that sticks in anybody's head. Do the Japanese and Taiwanese pop acts do a similar thing, sing verses in their own language and then the chorus in English?
I definitely see varying degrees of it. You know, what's interesting is a lot of people ask, you know, how much English should be used, or for that matter, how much Korean should be used in making songs that hopefully will cross over. And I usually point the finger to a band from Iceland, Sigur Rós. They're singing and speaking in a language no one even knows, but it sounds great. And, you know, hopefully to someone who might be listening to Korean music for the first time, you know, they might get that kind of Sigur Rós experience. And as luck would have it, I believe Sigur Rós is headlining at Summer Sonic this year at Japan. So it'll be interesting to see how they stack up with the Korean acts.
I interviewed Sigur Rós in Reykjavik many years ago. Terribly nice chaps, not going to make great after-dinner speakers, I suspect, when the music thing stops working for them. Not scintillating in interview. Great records, however. Could you tell us a bit about your second track you have picked for us? This is Chang Ki-ha and the Faces.
That's correct. Yeah, Changgya has been an indie music sensation who's really crossed over and gone mainstream. This year was really his year at the Korean Music Awards. He cleaned up both for, I believe, Album of the Year and Musician of the Year, as well as Rock Album and Rock Song of the Year. And what's great is that he's been able to roll this critically acclaimed album of his over to Japan this year. And what's really interesting about him is, in addition to being a very talented singer-songwriter, on this particular album, he actually directed his own music videos. And although we're going to play a track from one of his singles, I think instead of hearing the song, if you get a chance to hunt it down on YouTube, watching the video will be very interesting as well. But I believe the song that we have lined up is a song called A Twosome.
It is.
And you know, again, as great as it is to listen to, if you ever get a chance, do check it out and watch the video as well.
Well, let's have a listen to it now. Andrew Muller and I gently pogoing to that one in the Midoriya studios. Bernie Cho, president of the Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB Collective. That was one of your choices on today's review. Really retrospective and sort of quite 1970s post-punk feeling to that.
Yeah, it's what's interesting is a lot of people reference him to a lot of sort of the stuff that was happening in the 70s Korean rock scene. And these days, particularly on the indie and the alternative side, a lot of the rock acts are getting a lot of critical acclaim, but more importantly, a lot of awareness overseas. What I love about a lot of the Korean indie bands is, in addition to great music, they often have even better names. And again, this year for Summer Sonic, some acts that are going to be going are Idiotape, who were the winners of the Electronic Dance Album of the Year at the Korean Music Awards, a band called The Cox, a band called Glen Check, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit, but more importantly, two amazing alt-rock bands with probably the two toughest tongue-twister names in the industry, Kukastand, and brace yourself, this one's not an easy one, Kunnumgwa Yoda Riding Stella.
I've got the last bit. Forgive me for not getting the other bit.
Where did those? I just want to talk a bit about Changgya a little bit further. That last act we heard, which did put me very much in mind of those, you know, skinny-tied late '70s new wave English bands, you know, Gang of Four, Magazine, etc., etc. Where did that influence come from in Korea, and at what point did it arrive?
Well, I think what's interesting is all of these bands that I just mentioned are all really from this one art school district here in Seoul called Hongdae. And because, you know, you have a collective really of designers, directors, and music artists, they really tap into a lot of influences. And what we're finding more and more is obviously they have influences from overseas. But more of the younger artists these days are experimenting and exploring some of the older Korean music that was done in the 70s and the 80s and are really drawing samples and influences from there. And so, for instance, a lot of people don't know that Korea had a tremendously rich, funky R&B rock era in the 70s. And it's only now that younger artists are sort of going back to that for their influences and sort of in many ways reinterpreting that into the sound. And then also I think for a lot of these Korean artists, you know, they're very well educated in terms of musical trends around the world, and for whatever reason have found a way to kind of centrifuge a lot of those influences and have it come out as something very unique and in some instances very Korean, but at the same time somewhat recognizable, but with a bit of a twist.
Well, you mentioned Glen Check there a little while ago. We're going to go to them shortly, and can you tell us a bit about them first?
Yeah, Glen Check's interesting in the sense that they're a very new band that has really just emerged on the scene over the past year. And what's interesting about them is they don't like to go on television. They don't like to do interviews. And in many instances, their songs are often done mostly in English. And for whatever reason, it's connecting with Korean audiences. And they're really the whole package. They art direct their own covers. they deal with their own visuals, and obviously they write and perform their own music. And what's really interesting about Glencheck is that with really little to no traditional promotions, be it, you know, advertising and whatnot, they're selling out shows here in Seoul. So it's really exciting to see them just quickly elevate and jump over to Japan to, you know, test the waters there.
As we heard a moment ago, Changki Ha and the Faces were a band that arguably are the people that you really should listen to live. At Glencheck, the same kind of genre? And also, and if so, how big is this the sort of gig scene in Seoul?
Well, it's, again, I think it's a testament really to how the festival scene has really expanded and exploded here. Live music is definitely where it's at these days. And so although, again, a lot of these teen idol dance acts get a lot of attention on the airwaves, when you're going into the clubs and going into the festivals where it's packed with 20, 40, 60,000 people in an open field, it's testament that, you know, the live music scene is really coming up strong and in some ways experiencing an amazing revival. And again, what's great is that some of these younger acts, I find it exciting that sometimes you can't put them in a genre because they're sampling and tapping from so many different sources. And Glencheck's one of those acts where are they in a rock band, electronic act, or what are they? But as far as I can tell and as far as I know, you know, I think the name of their first album, Haute Couture, is pretty accurate. And so, yeah, Glencheck from their new album, their song is aptly titled Vogue Boys and Girls. So should we give that a kick and spin?
Let's do exactly that. But as we go into that, we'll say thank you very much to our guest reviewer this week, Bernie Cho, president of Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB Collective.
And that was Glencheck, Vogue Boys and Girls. The third music choice of our music reviewer today, Bernie Cho, president of the Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Stay with us because in a moment we'll be joined by a lady who's a creative force in the East End of London.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's Saturday, and you're listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Andrew Muller. I'm delighted to say, for our music, our magazine review, we're joined now by the founder and director of The Whopping Project, Jules Wright. A very warm welcome to the studio, Jules. Thank you for extracting yourself from East London on this Olympic weekend. What's the atmosphere like down there at the moment?
I'm not in East London this morning. I'm next to Tate Modern, which is where I live. And it was extremely quiet there with nobody going to the Tate. Actually, we're chopped off in Wapping by an Olympic lane. So Wapping is now an island. So it's exceptionally quiet.
It must be. I never could consider Wapping to be much of an island. So how are you coping over there? Is it all right? Do you have enough milk and bread and what have you? Do we need to helicopter in?
If it's delivered between midnight and 3 a.m. or someone comes in on a Boris bike, yes.
See, so far at the risk of tempting fate, having come in from the Olympic borough of Waltham Forest myself this morning, is absolutely no trouble at all. I think they've spent months lowering expectations. I think the local government and media have been conditioning Londoners to anticipate that it's going to be an absolute catastrophe. So when it actually really isn't, everyone's going to go, this is amazing.
Tell us a little bit more about the Whopping Project and how you came about founding it, because you came from a theatrical background, didn't
you? I did, Royal Court. In fact, Danny Boyle was an assistant director to me.
What was he like at the time?
He was a very, very fine director, shall we say.
And what was your verdict of last night?
I thought he did a great job, actually. I didn't love everything, but I thought the great skill of Danny is to trust people he works with. So I think things like the Thomas Heatherwick piece was an absolute joy, and I think Akram Khan's piece. So I think that Danny's a great team worker, and I think that's what produces the kind of movies he makes when he's really on top form, and I think it produced last night.
And how much of Danny Boyle's style do you think came out in the ceremony? Because he obviously had to comply with an awful lot of rules and regulations in terms of what he could and couldn't do.
He did, but I think, you know, the thing I liked about it, Danny's a deeply political person, and it was there. And I think that in that kind of context, it's probably pretty hard to fight for it. So I thought that it was a piece of work done with a lot of integrity and single-mindedly. Because obviously there are things one would criticise, and I think there's a kind of bravery in it, and I think I would have been terribly nervous.
The political stuff was hard to miss, but I think he did it with such a... There was such a verve and a cheek about it.
Yes, I agree.
That I think you would have need to be a real dyed-in-the-wool headbanger to have taken violent objection to any of it. I love the NHS bit. I thought it was great. Just... But I also just think, as somebody who's lived in this country for 22 years and has come to love most of its kind of quirks and foibles, I just thought that was the moment at which a billion people around the world are watching going, what? and I really like that. It was the equivalent of Sydney's prawns on bicycles moment.
Well, you can
I thought.
Just about yeah. get a prawn on a barbecue, that's it. But an entire, exactly. you know, free at the point of service, almost welfare state, you know, absolutely individual, incomplete system is slightly more baffling, I'd argue.
To a lot of people, yes.
Maybe baffling, but... I mean, my pleasure in that was to look at David Cameron's face, basically. Well, so I thought it was a great piece of work and I enjoyed it enormously, that piece. I think the beginning for me was I felt uncomfortable at the beginning. I thought, oh, my God, I don't think I'm going to like this.
It's when I saw a Morris dancer, oh. I sort of my stomach started to tighten ever so slightly.
Yeah. So, yeah, mine did
yes,
too.
Yes, please make this stop soon. And then the enormous chimneys came up and they were fabulous and... awfully rude and very brutal and brilliant and totally William Blake. And we thought, OK, this is good.
I think the subversion of lots of things worked, actually.
No,
I thought the ending was a bit odd, I have to say.
Which ending?
The last song of the evening.
Yes, it was.
I thought, OK. I didn't quite see how that
Some criticism is that it went on a little bit too long.
Yeah,
that
maybe.
They should have all gone home after the lighting of the torch, and maybe Sir Paul McCartney could have been brought out of the box at a later
Perhaps,
date.
Perhaps, because I think we all forget the words of Hey Jude, don't we?
We began that incredibly long exploration of last night's Olympic ceremony with us asking you about the Wapping Project. Tell us what it's all about for those who've never been to it.
The Wapping Project is an arts building. It's a power station. It's a building that I found, I first worked in 92. I made a film in that building and that's how I discovered it. And I became obsessed by it and I wanted to no longer be answerable to large boards, which I had been in my various other roles at the Royal Court and at Liverpool Playhouse. And so it became an obsession. And in 1998, we finally got the freehold. We, being a charitable trust, I set up at the court in 81. And we commission everything. Everything that happens there is new. And it's I commission writers, poets, choreographers, composers, etc., etc., across the arts. And the work is funded by a restaurant, which I set up once I realised I had no public funding and what was I doing with my life. And I think I've now become a waitress. I'm quite good, actually. Come to us on a Saturday night. So it's an exciting building in which lots of new things happen and in which I am very able to take risks without having to ask anybody if I may do so. It's a vibrant and exciting building.
I did want to, unfortunately, ask you about the funding aspect of this because it was £4 million to get it converted.
It was, yeah.
Knowing a tiny little bit about the theatre scene in London at the moment and knowing that the use of derelict buildings is often quite a popular option because it is cheap, do you think there is any possibility that what you did then with the Wapping Project could be done now?
Well, I don't actually. I think, number one, developers are much sharper and finding those buildings before people like myself. I think that there was a kind of stupidity in what I did because I didn't have the money. But somehow... in the 90s, I don't know, I wasn't afraid of doing it. I mean, what can happen to you? You're not going to end up dead if you get it wrong. So it didn't really worry me if I got it wrong. And I didn't think at all about what I would do once I'd finished it. I didn't know what was going to happen when I opened the door. So on the day that I did open the door and we sold our first cup of coffee, it was kind of unbelievable. And from that, and there was not a penny in the coffers at that point because I had no more money to spend. And so it's been hand to mouth in a way ever since. However, it's been hand to mouth without having to answer to anybody at all. And I think that gives you an obviously an immense amount of freedom, but it also enables you to take lots of risks because it doesn't matter what goes wrong.
Well, on that inspiring thought, which I'm sure a lot of people have, I'm sure it's a reassurance a lot of people have made themselves when doing something like launching a magazine.
I have to say I'm Australian as well, so that's probably another reason I went
I'm
in that
surrounded.
Direction.
I know.
Again.
Emma was surrounded last night and she's surrounded now. What's the first of the titles you've brought in today?
The first is Apartamento, which is a Spanish magazine. And I brought it in because I'm eternally interested in the lives of other people and how they conduct it behind closed doors. And it's a magazine about people's lives and their homes, but artists, people working in fields like myself or associated fields. But it's not posh. It's not about pretending to be something that you are not. It's not only allowing photographers to come in to the bit that you've tidied up.
It's not the Hello Magazine variety celebrity X welcomes us into their lovely home and with their delightful family.
No, it's not. It's come into my house, it's a terrible mess, but this is how I live and I find that one gets closer to the people that are being interviewed. So it's actually people's houses being or homes being used as a vehicle to the story that they want to tell about their lives or that they're encouraged to tell about their lives.
You've also brought in the amazing Acne paper.
Yes.
Tell us why you love it so much. I mean, it is so gorgeous, so timeless, and it is the, you know, the envy, what was it? It's been described as the envy of the mainstream glossy, and its enduring appeal. I'm always so pleased when someone brings in the Acne paper when we're doing the review.
I bring it in because the editor is, for me, one of the most inspiring editors working within the magazine industry, Thomas Persson, he's Swedish. And the magazine works around a theme in each edition. The writing is excellent. He commissions superbly. The photography is also excellent, with people with very strong individual voices. But above all, it's finely edited. So I find it utterly inspiring. They're very often very short pieces, strong, narratively written pieces. But when I read it, for example, I grabbed one from home today because I didn't go to my office to get the most recent edition. And it's about youth. And I was looking through it before I came into the studio and I was reminded how many people within those two covers, you know, one wants to meet, wants to commission, wants to get engaged with. And I think that's what I always find with Acne. It's incredibly inspiring. And I can come up with entire programs as a consequence of reading one volume of Acne. But I think that comes through the quality of his editorship.
There's something about the Acne paper which is that very difficult, but successful, but when he pulls it off, that successful blending of history and absolute cutting edge. And yeah, the copy that you've brought in today has a Rembrandt self-portrait,
yes,
and then a ballet dancer,
yeah,
in it.
Yes.
How that is a really tricky balance to strike, isn't it?
It is, but he always manages to do it because I think that it's an intellectually robust magazine. And I think more and more and more people are reading it, and maybe people look through just for the imagery. But for me, it's the text that I can read over a number of weeks, months, and that's also true of all the magazines I've brought in, actually. So it's that robustness, that authority that comes from great editorship.
And what's the next one in the heap over there?
I think my next one is Teller, which is a small magazine, which is funded by crowdfunding, which I think is a very interesting territory. It's a British magazine, and it's short stories, basically, but it's a very political magazine. So you've got young, I suppose on the whole, youngish people, young writers, writing well-constructed short stories which address very clearly the world in which we live. And I think that we often assume that a lot of young people are not politically incisive. And what's interesting about Teller is that that's exactly what it is. And so I like to, I mean, I'm an avid reader anyways, and I love stories, so I read it because of the stories. But I also read it because of its political bite.
And how does that crowdfunding model of theirs work? Do they just invite donations to their own via their own website, or do they have a dedicated fundraising platform?
No, they're using one of the American platforms.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're working in a more conventional way, but through the American platforms.
How do you think it sits or sort of fights against the likes of Granter, who are the absolute establishment in this field?
It's a younger piece, and it's a baby alongside of Granter. And it's, I guess at the moment it doesn't have the same kind of pull, but maybe it doesn't want to have the same kind of pull of major writers writing pieces for Granter. We must remember, Granter is extremely well-funded. So it's a slightly different situation. I would imagine, I don't know, that the writers who are writing for Teller are probably not being paid. And for many of them, it's probably first opportunities, but there's some excellent writing, and again, really well-edited.
And finally, and very briefly, Jules, you brought in the White Review. Again, the fiction genre again.
OK, I brought in White Review partly because it's a baby of Wapping, and it grew up in my glass house in the garden because I paid the editors to look after my bookshop. And again, it's excellently broadly based, narratively written, well edited, and with exciting people like Deborah Levy, who has just been longlisted for the Booker Prize.
And with that, Jules Wright, director of the Wapping Project, thank you for joining us as today's guest magazine reviewer. This is the review on Monocle 24.
That brings us to the end of this review. It's goodbye from all of us here on Midori House. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bildbauer, our researcher, Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson. Have a great weekend.
Goodbye.